Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 2 months from now, seems like a long time, but you know it's going to sneak up and bite you. The tax return, that is. Joining us now to cut through some of the red tape is AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader Bruce Gelsinger. Welcome back to the show, Bruce.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
And also Mary McVicker. She's a CPA and is representing the Ohio Society of CPAs today. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
If you have a question or comment, this is your chance. They're going to be with us for the next two segments until about 10:40. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don't wait till the last minute. If you have questions on your tax returns, deductions, anything like that, changes, we're going to try to get to as much of that as we can now. But I always appreciate your calls and emails. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mary, let's start with the changes such as they are and, you know, what people can look for in terms of change.
I think a lot of the change we see that we've seen in the past, there in December and a lot of compromises which were made, were in the big round picture of the Bush tax cuts. Are we going to see an extension of the tax rates where they are? Are they going to increase? Capital gains rates, are they going up? Estate taxation, what's going on with that? As many people know, 2010, it was sunset and expired, and there wasn't an estate tax provision. So we saw in December where we retroactively now can have an estate tax. We got favorable rates that were reduced where it was going to go to 55%. Now we're at 35%. So we saw a lot of changes there in big picture tax law. A lot of things that people were worried about, AMT patch. Every year, alternative minimum tax includes more and more people. And a lot of the reason for that is it's an alternative system to tax people that doesn't catch up with inflation. So we see this patch happen every year, and every year we wait for it, and again it happened. That's kind of the big picture. I know, Bruce, you have some thoughts, too, on, as far as individual extenders, things like that, what we'll see in credits.
Well, I think some of the things that come into play on the 1040, on the bottom of the first page, there's some adjustments, and one of those is a tuition and fees deductions, which was reinstated. That was due to expire. It's been reinstated. Another is the educator credit. So anyone who is a teacher, K through 12, perhaps buys some classroom supplies, can deduct a portion of those classroom supplies on the return. And that was true in prior years, but that was due to expire. So we have a few things like that. One of the things, last year, people could deduct a real estate tax without filing the Schedule A, the itemized deductions. That has now gone away. So that was just a one-year item.
So now you have to go back to the itemized deductions.
Now you have to go back
that.
To itemized if you're going to deduct the real estate tax. Yes.
Are there more itemized deductions? Are there more opportunities to deduct, and therefore is itemization more attractive?
People who have high medical costs or mortgage interest, real estate taxes, maybe are heavy contributors to their church and other nonprofit organizations, will probably benefit by filing the Schedule A itemized deductions. The amount of deductions on that page really hasn't changed much, but it's those types of categories which people will generally use to select whether they're going to do an itemized deduction or a standard deduction.
What about people who have been struggling, people who are on unemployment, their incomes have dropped precipitously, maybe they haven't made anything this year? I know we have an email from Debbie. She says, due to the bad economy, I had zero income literally for 2010 and will not be owing any taxes. Is it better to send in forms with nothing but zeros or on them, or to just skip the whole process and save on postage?
What? Actually, that's a good question, because the IRS does have requirements on who must file. And a single person, for example, under 65, if you have less than about $9,000 of income, you don't have to file.
The one thing I would throw in there, though, is if you don't file, there's not a statute of limitations. You haven't started the clock running. So if you don't file and you're 100% sure nothing at all happened for that year, that's one thing. But if you don't file and it comes back later that there was income earned in that year, remember that the statute of limitations has not started then. So the IRS can go back and assess penalties and interest from when that return was due. Because, you know, there's a statute of limitations for federal purposes of 3 years, which can be extended to 6 years, look back period. But that's one thing to consider. Just consider, is there any risk or exposure? Is there any harm to filing a zero return? Absolutely not. is it administratively burdensome? And if you know for sure that it's zero, then I would consider that as well.
There is another caveat, especially for seniors who may be withdrawing funds from an IRA or from a mutual fund. Every transaction is a taxable event. There may or may not be tax due on it because it determines it's based on the basis of that investment.
Mm-hmm.
But in those cases, I would also recommend you work up the numbers and file a return to reconcile the numbers, because the IRS does get a record of those proceeds.
So when you talk about the statute of limitations, if there's some income reported or they get audited, the statute then, there is no limit. It could start at any time 10 years from now.
Right. A return you file now for 2010, if I file it today, the statute starts running the day it's filed. So if I've never filed a return, then I don't have a statute. And there's exposure out there. If there is, I mean, I think that's the big caveat. If you're certain or if you're not, then go from there.
The number I threw out about the $9,000 being single and having low income is a true statement. However, if you had some earned income, you may qualify for the Making Work Pay credit, and you certainly want to.
Making Work Pay?
Yes. That was a credit that was instituted last year, I believe.
When we're talking tax years, we're talking 2009.
That's always living in the past.
Yes.
I know. I say that every day.
But there are various credits. There's the earned income credit. There could be a child tax credit if there's a dependent child for the taxpayer who emailed us that note. So it is recommended to go through those. Some of those are refundable credits. Some are just take your tax liability down to zero, but some are actually refundable, like the earned income credit.
My guests are AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader Bruce Gelsinger and also Mary McVicker. She's a CPA, and she's representing the Ohio Society of CPAs today. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsigns@wosu.org. We're really interested in your questions today. We're talking about tax preparation for 2010. Your tax returns are due on April 18th this year, 3 extra days. But if you're like me, sometimes the procrastination is worse than
ever.
Well,
that's the federal return date.
Yes, the federal, right. The state hasn't changed.
The state has not changed. They're still due April 15th.
Okay. Any state changes, any big state changes?
Nothing really major this year. The form's been revised a little bit. Last year, the military pensions were exempt from Ohio taxes for active duty, and that continues. But I don't believe there's any other major Ohio changes this year.
No, what I would consider more changes that affect us as Ohio citizens, look at your cities, your municipalities where you live. We saw Columbus go to a 2.5 rate. At the end of 2009, there for the last quarter, we're seeing a lot of municipalities do tax rate changes and school district changes as well. Always check to see if you're in a school district that's just implemented a new tax that used to not have a tax rate and now does. That's the one thing I would consider, is make sure you have an understanding for what your municipality is doing and what they have done and changed.
Jerry from Northwest Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher. Mm-hmm. Outstanding program. I've been paying my income taxes for more years than I care to remember, and I don't object to that. Just remember that Congress writes rules for this. The Internal Revenue Service just enforces them. I never had a problem in calling the IRS. I want to make that clear.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as Mark Twain was quoted last week, it could probably be proven with facts and figures that Congress is America's original native criminal class. But my question is, I'm legally blind, but if I'm marked legally blind and I do take my itemized deductions, then they take that away from me. Why in the dickens? If you're in your 80s and you're a veteran, why don't they give you a break? And
you just said so yourself. It's Congress, right?
Well, mea culpa.
Well, you are correct that if you take a standard deduction and blind or senior citizen do get an extra bump on the standard deduction. But when you itemize deductions, all your expenses get rolled in there that are legitimate deductions.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. But I also just wanted your listeners to know that it's not the IRS. It's the Congress that does it. Okay. And they take care of themselves. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Take care, folks. Jerry. 614-292-8513. Get your calls in early. Our guests today, AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader Bruce Gelsinger and also Mary McVicker from the Ohio Society of CPAs, are only going to be with us until 10:40. Second question that Debbie had in her email. If I don't owe taxes this year, but I have a large capital loss carryover, can I just hold on to that amount until I do submit taxes in a year when I will hopefully have income, or do I lose the $3,000 anyway?
That is a good question, and you should file your tax return. You will lose it anyway by the tax law, but you should file a tax return to track it.
It's an event.
Yes.
As you would put it. Okay.
Yeah,
Debbie.
And your Schedule D, it carries forward year to year, so you do need to file. You can't just start skipping years.
And she says, thanks for asking. Thanks for answering these questions. I obviously can't afford to pay for tax advice. So thank you from all the folks out there. This email from Mike writes, as an independent contractor who receives most of my income from one source in the UK, I submit a 1099 miscellaneous for most of my income. I will be receiving a payment of about $35,000 extra this year that can either be seen as a bonus, commission, or salary. Is there any particular way to receive this that will be more advantageous to me tax-wise?
Non-employee compensation, which is a 1099 miscellaneous form box 7, which is what he's referring to, needs to be shown on a Schedule C or CEZ. Expenses can be deducted that were inherent in producing that income, but whether it's classified as a bonus or salary or whatever, it's all reportable on the tax. And then there's the Social Security offset or equivalent that has to also be calculated on that income.
And, I mean, as far as how he receives it, if he receives it on a 1099, obviously it is Schedule C income. If he's receiving it as a W-2, you know, that can still be Schedule C. If he's receiving it in 2011, the one thing I would throw out there is we had the make-work-pay credit in 2010. In 2011, we actually have what might even be more advantageous to most wage earners, which is a 2% payroll holiday. So the 6.2% payroll tax, the employee portion of that, is reduced to 4.2. As a self-employed, it would be reduced to 10.4. So he is seeing some benefit there, but he's going to get – it will be taxed to him.
There's not an more advantageous way than another to file it.
It's going to be how he receives it.
Okay.
If he receives it as payroll, then there would be payroll tax already taken out of it. But if he receives it as a 1099, either which way, it's going to be reported on his return the same way.
Okay. We have to take a break. When we return, we'll continue with our Q&A with AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader Bruce Gelsinger and Mary McVicker of the Ohio Society of CPAs. I see your calls. We'll get to them as soon as we return. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR.
This is 89.7 NPR News. At 1 o'clock, On Point begins with a discussion of the housing market. Will the housing market ever hit bottom? On Point looks at the still sinking home prices in Seattle and Atlanta. And the White House plans to wind down market makers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That discussion at 1 on Point, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
And it's 53 degrees in downtown Columbus. A nice day today, partly sunny and a high of 64. There is a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 53 degrees. A chance of rain for Friday and then sunshine later in the day and a high right around 60. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. Federal tax returns are due April 18th this year. It's three extra days, but your state and your local are still due on April 15th. So we invited a couple of people into the studio that can help you prepare your taxes or help you choose somebody to do it for you, which is a topic we'll get to. AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader Bruce Gelsinger and also Mary McVicker, who's representing the Ohio Society of CPAs. There's a second question on the email from Mike. He says, I currently have no 401k, Roth IRA, or any other similar vehicle, but would it make sense to set something up so that the payment can be made directly into it?
The payment from his what he's doing as an employee?
I would
just
imagine,
make sure I'm reading that. Yes, I think you can do a couple of things. You can set up a a SEP plan, which can be done by the time you file your tax return April 15th. This is a self-employed plan where basically you're setting up a contribution to an IRA. The other thing is, if you do set up a Roth IRA, I think it is. I think you do want to do something as far as retirement savings. We saw a lot of changes with Roth IRAs in the past year, where you can do a conversion from a traditional, which has always been the traditional IRA everyone could do. The Roth IRA was not available to everyone. Now everyone can convert their traditional to their Roth. There's not the 100,000 limitation that there used to be as far as adjusted gross income. Everyone can do it. And if you did it in 2010, you can pay the tax on that conversion in 2011 and 12. Which is an advantage that's not addressed in that email. But yes, I think a retirement savings vehicle is a good idea to invest in.
Okay. 614-292-8513, or email us your questions at allsides@wosu.org. Dale from North Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hey, simple question. Is unemployment compensation considered earned income?
It is taxable income.
I had him take taxes out of it.
Okay.
I don't believe it's eligible for the earned income credit. If that's where you're going with this, I honestly don't think so.
I don't think so. There are various components of the tax law where some of them qualify for earned income for some of the things and not others, but I don't believe that is an earned income.
I love certainty.
Yes. The tax law is full of it.
Thank you, Dale.
I thank you for your time.
You bet. 614-292-8513. And George from the East Columbus, welcome to the show.
Good morning, everyone. My question is, I had a business where I built out an office space in a building that I did not own. The ownership of the building changed, and we couldn't work out an agreement in terms of clientele and other things, so I had to move. My concern is I basically lost all the money I took out to build the space in the building. Other than the depreciation that I was taking every year on the taxes, is there anything else I can do regarding my loss?
Okay, so you own this building as an investment? I'm sorry.
No, you improved the building, but you don't own it, right?
Okay.
Right. I improved part of the office space in a building that I did not own.
Mm-hmm. But you rented it for your business.
I rented it for my business, and I built out the space. I mean, we're talking about like over $100,000 of new built-out cost for improvement.
Okay. And now you sold the building, or you're not there anymore?
Right. The original owners who, when I rented the space out, the ownership changed. And they brought in a whole new type of business in the building that I couldn't stay.
Okay.
In the building.
So you were forced out, right? Okay.
Well, not forced, but I mean, it wasn't going to be compatible for my clientele.
Right, okay.
So I had to leave the building.
If it's a form of investment, then obviously there's the capital loss available from that. If you took deductions due to paying rent and the improvements you made, then that's kind of the benefit you're getting there is through that. But I don't know if I'm getting everything correct from this, but basically any investment you had in it, then you would have most likely capital loss coming back from that.
Okay. Drew.
So I probably conclude that under capital loss.
Yeah.
I, That, yeah, I think you might want to look at that a little bit further to see what you've put in and what the loss is before making a final decision. I'm not sure I have all the components to that, but if it's truly an investment, yes, then you would see a capital loss component to it.
Thanks, George. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Dennis in Columbus, welcome to the show. Hi,
yes,
Dennis.
Hello.
Yep.
Yes, I had a question on the when they raised the age limit for dependent. I had a question. Can I deduct buying eyeglasses for my son? He's 25. Well, can I put it on my flexible spending account if he files his own taxes?
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Dennis.
We saw a lot of changes to flexible spending accounts at the end of 2010. As far as if the flexible spending, I think the answer here is yes. And Bruce, I don't know if you want to chime in as well, but I think the answer here is yes, that you would, as a dependent for the flexible spending that it would be, yes, it wouldn't be, the deduction comes from you've contributed to your flexible spending, that's pre-tax income, so that's the form of the deduction that you're speaking of. Would it be, the next question is, would it be an eligible expense, and I think the answer is yes.
What I would add to that would be on a Schedule A, you could not deduct it if you are taking it out of your flexible spending account.
Okay. So this email from the listener, there was a deduction or credit for medical spending accounts. Has that been eliminated from the federal 1040A?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. 614-292-8513. And Bill from Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question for the professionals is, what do you think of the software packages that are almost free now? Especially with myself as an independent person, contractor, and my wife is a W-2 wage earner, and we have an investment property.
There are several tax packages out there, which, as you say, some of them are almost free. I would encourage you to walk through the interview and make sure you understand the questions that are being asked. They all, to the best of my knowledge, they all do an adequate job, but they need to be interpreted properly.
Well, yeah, that's the question. Interpreting some of the questions sometimes gets very tenuous. But is there any feedback of how much users like myself, an average person, how much error rate they're experiencing on such a thing?
You know, that's a good question, Bill. Our guest coming up in the next segment, Mike, he's investigative reporter who looks at the process of filing taxes pretty closely. So he might have some thoughts about that, okay?
I'll listen in. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. I'm sorry, though, Mary, did you have anything?
No, I don't think I have much.
Okay. So let's see. Thanks, Bill. 614-292-8513. And Esther from Linden, welcome to the show.
Yes. I'm calling. I'm a senior citizen, and my income is $10,776 a year, and I haven't filed, I just live on my Social Security check, and I haven't filed income tax for several years because I called IRS one time, and I forget what they said when a person on Social Security has to file, what is the limit or how much do they have to be receiving on Social Security before they that requires that they file income tax.
And mm-hmm. Has that changed, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. Now, should I file income tax on this, the amount I get every year? Like, say, for instance, say a little over $10,000. Mm-hmm.
If your income is due to Social Security only, no, you do not need to file. If you have other income streams like a pension, annuity or something of that nature, then you may need to file if it's over $10,000. But if it's just Social Security alone, you do not need to file.
Well, what about if I ever, my Social Security, say it went, what level do they start filing when they're on Social Security? Do you know?
If it's Social Security only, there is no level.
You don't file.
You don't file if it's just Social Security income. If you have other income streams, be it you sold some mutual funds, you have dividends or interest or pension, then you may need to file if it's over $10,000, excluding the Social Security component.
Yeah, I don't have that.
Okay.
What about if I give to my church and I pay taxes on my home and I give to, say, for instance, different charities that mail me things to give to them, donations, is there any way that I could recoup that?
If you don't need to file taxes and you don't owe any taxes, those are only deductions to take you down to zero taxes. If you're already there, there's no benefit.
Yeah, there's no refund for that, unfortunately.
Thanks, Esther. Take care. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. We have about eight more minutes with our experts. We have some emails as well. This one's from Carrie. I have always prepared my own taxes through TurboTax. They are fairly simple. I do itemize because I have a couple kids and I own a house. A little over a year ago, my job changed to a work-at-home position. I've heard there are more deductions I can take because I work 100% from home. Is this true? If so, is it still simple to do this through TurboTax, or would it be better to find a CPA to help prepare my taxes?
That's...
Now, Mary.
Oh, that's a good question.
It is.
Obviously, you want to feel comfortable with what you're doing on the tax return. And if you're hesitant to what, you know, is going in and what's allowed, then obviously I think it's time, you know, consult someone. And the Ohio Society, you know, has resources available for you by either calling. There's a 1-800 number, 1-888-959-1212. Or financialfitnessohio.com, which has resources on, you know, tax advisors that, you know, that would be able to help you kind of meet. I think the important thing about tax advisors is a couple of things. One, know what you need. Know what the expertise is that you need. You don't want to use a sledgehammer for a nail if it's not necessary. You don't want to get too much help when if your situation is just, you know, where do I start from this year? And then obviously, once you start from there, you can always look at your resources later and say, you know, does it make sense that I use someone this year and next year I work on this my own? Know what you need, and then know the credentials of the person that you eventually do use. But I would just recommend, what's your comfort level? If you think that TurboTax can help you get there, or whatever software program you're using, that's your best judgment. But there are resources available out there for other preparers as well.
If you are working from home and think you may qualify for the home office deduction, I would certainly recommend a CPA or other professional tax preparer to work through that. That's a very complicated issue.
Yeah, I think her question kind of answers it. You know, if you don't know what's out there, then get someone who can help you know what is all available.
Jeanette from Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I wanted to know, I've been sick a long time. And I was fine while I worked with the IRS, but then I became ill, and I have a problem with them. I don't know what it is, and I don't understand these things anymore.
Where can you get help?
Right.
Okay.
There is a taxpayer advocate service, which is a special service that is inside of the IRS, but they handle situations such as that. And I would suggest you call them or email them. The number would be 877-777-4778.
Okay, so that's, Jeanette, that's 877-777-4778.
Yes.
Okay?
Okay, that's great.
All right. Take care, Jeanette.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Caller from Columbus, welcome to the show.
And first and foremost, your program is fantastic. I listen to you every day.
Thank you.
My question is, I'm a married full-time professional paying taxes at the highest bracket, and my husband, he was a student for some time. Currently, he is not working and not studying. But if he's refusing to do married filing joint for a variety of reasons, what are my options?
If he refuses to do married filing jointly, you would have to file married filing separately. You don't get to choose you don't get to choose single. You would be married filing separately or married filing jointly.
Okay.
And how much of a time period do you have for any possible amendment?
As far as I believe you would do it within statute. So if you filed a return, today, you would have the 3-year statute to look at. So 3 years from today would be the last time you would want to amend your return.
So the statutes work both ways. Right. It's for you to change things if you find out.
Please keep in mind that while married filing separate status is available to many people, you are sacrificing some of the credits and some of the deductions on that.
I believe, if you do married filing separately, you would both either have to itemize or not itemize. So married filing separately is not always the best option, but it can be depending on your income situation as a couple.
Okay. Thank you, caller from Columbus. Dave from Gahanna, welcome to the show.
Hi, I have a question about purchases on Amazon.com. I buy textbooks, and then I also buy just books for personal reading. And I had a friend tell me that if those are purchased out of state and shipped into Ohio, then you owe tax on those.
That is correct. There is a spot on the Ohio income tax form where you should report the tax on those purchases.
Does it matter if it's a textbook?
I don't believe it does.
No, I think you're looking there at a sales tax, use tax situation. I honestly don't know that for sure, but I don't believe it matters. It would be the product you're purchasing.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Take care. Stephanie from Cincinnati, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. My question was about if you loan somebody a couple $1,000 and and you don't charge them interest or anything like that, but and this person is now overseas just now, and it'll probably be there for quite a while, but when they get you paid back, do you have to count that as income on income tax?
No. I think the risk there is the IRS would look at, does it make sense that there's no interest being charged component to it? But you're looking at a situation where basically it's a balancing cash went out, cash comes in, everyone's restored whole at the end of the day. No income was generated from it, so no.
Okay.
Well, thanks. As I said, it won't be in the same year because I loaned the money quite a while back.
If you think about what income is, there's not an income. There wasn't an income pickup for the person that you loaned the money to, and there's not income coming back to you. So it's not a matter of the timing. It doesn't matter.
Thanks, Stephanie. One more time for one more, and Sue from Worthington, you're it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm going on a mission trip to Honduras, and I wondered if that's eligible for a tax deduction.
Okay. Thanks, Sue, for your call. Charity type of work like that?
Some expenses on charity type of work are if it's a qualified organization.
Okay,
yes.
Like a 501c3?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. We had a lot more calls, so we had to say thanks, but no thanks. I've already asked Mary and Bruce back maybe a few days before taxes are due for the procrastinators among us. So if you're that type of person, that show is for you, or if you just love to listen to these kinds of shows, that show's for you. My guests this hour, Mary McVicker, she's a CPA, and she was here representing the Ohio Society of CPAs. Thank you, Mary, for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And also, and his return engagement, Bruce Gelsinger, he's the AARP Regional Tax Aid Leader. Bruce, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, when we return, we're going to hear from a journalist who thinks that tax reform, the kind that actually makes it easier to file your taxes, is absolutely necessary. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
You're listening to 89.7 NPR News in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides. Here's about the life and times of 1960s political activist and singer and songwriter Phil Oakes. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Rez Abbasi's Invocation February 19th. Jazz guitarist Rez Abbasi draws upon driving sounds of Pakistani Qawwali with Rudresh Mahanthapa on sax. Tickets at wexarts.org.
Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the battle between unions and statehouse Republicans, also a proposal to expand Ohio's private school voucher program, and more. Tune in for Columbus on the Record tomorrow night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. And it's currently 53 degrees in downtown Columbus. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 64 degrees. A chance of rain tonight and a low of 53. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. David K. Johnston doesn't claim that he can end the burden of filing taxes, but he is confident that the system can be improved. The Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist has spent decades examining U.S. tax laws. David joins us today to talk about fundamental tax reform and whether simplification is possible or just a dream. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You say the number one issue is complexity, but that until we acknowledge that we all benefit to some degree from the myriad provisions, we won't get anything done to fix it.
That's true. We don't all benefit, though, Ann.
Okay.
One of the things I have argued is that for about 70% of Americans, there should be no need to file tax returns. And it's only because of campaign contributions by Intuit, which gave $1 million to a single California state politician, and other contributions by the tax preparation industry, that most Americans have to fill out a tax return.
How could it be that 70% should have no need?
Because 70% of people file a short form. That is, they don't take advantage of, because they don't qualify for them, any of the benefits like the mortgage interest deduction or the deduction of state and local income taxes or property taxes. And most Americans, remember, have small incomes. The average income of the bottom half of taxpayers is only about $16,000, and the threshold to get out of the bottom half is about $33,000. So up until the Reagan era, if you only had a modest amount of income that wasn't from either wages or wage-like things, like a pension, that is, you only had a small amount of interest income or dividend income, you didn't even have to pay taxes on it. And if we went back to that system, which would encourage people to save, and said you could have $500 or $1,000 per person, twice that for a married couple, in dividend or interest income without being taxed, which would encourage savings.
Mm-hmm.
The government has everything it needs to file your tax return. All you have to tell the government is, here's my Social Security number, here's that of my spouse if I'm married, and my dependents if I have any. And the government already is told by your employer how much you were paid, how much you got in dividends, interest, et cetera. It already has this information. And they're doing this, by the way, in California very successfully in a project that Intuit has managed to limit to a few tens of thousands of people, but we could expand nationwide very easily.
So they've already got the information they need. Then what do they do with it? They send you a bill or they send you a check?
Well, depending on whether you have money coming back, mm-hmm. that would determine what you're going to get. But remember, most people at the low end of the income stream have more money withheld from their checks than they need to pay at the end of the year. And so what happens to them is that they end up getting a refund. And once if the government knows what your income is, what your filing status is, and how many people are on your tax return. That's all it needs. And it can send you a notice saying, by our calculation, you know, here's your tax information and you get this much money or you owe us this much money. And that's the end of it. Unless you want to challenge it, and then you can file your own return.
My guest is David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, spent decades examining U.S. tax laws. If you have a question or comment for David, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, that's another option. Tax preparers are now regulated to some degree. Are you satisfied with the changes?
Well, it's a good beginning. We clearly had a problem with tax preparers, both working for the name brand companies and little mom and pop operations, who tell people they're going to maximize their refund. And we actually have people who report more income than they have. The maximum earned income tax credit for working people is at about $10,500 to $13,500. That's not very much money. But if your income is only $6,000, then many people will do things like report a business that doesn't exist to jack their income up to $10,500 so that they can get back tax benefit. And if we had better regulation of tax preparers, we could reduce that problem.
What kind of regulations would reduce that problem?
Well, requiring these people, first of all, to be trained, requiring them to be identifiable and to then hold them responsible. Because their name and identification number is filed with their return. And this is one of those classic, you know, problems like with doctors. You know, we regulate every doctor in the country, even though we know it's a tiny percentage of doctors who abuse the system to get excessive reimbursement.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, it is a small number of tax preparers who cause most of the problems in this area. So I don't see any reason for the government not to regulate this area of activity. I mean, good grief, we regulate in many states, you know, landscapers and elevator repairmen. And this is an issue of protecting the FISC, the government's revenue.
You know, I wanted to get into this in the last segment with our CPA and AARP consultant. But do you have any advice for people about how to choose a tax preparer?
Well, first of all, if all you have is wage or pension or withdrawal from your 401k income, you probably don't need a tax preparer. And if you find the forms intimidating, if you're a low-income person, go to what's called a VITAS center. Get to a computer, go to Google. Every community has volunteers who help particularly older Americans prepare their tax return. Secondly, if you're doing a short form, to spend $75 or $80 to have someone do it is just, you know, an utter waste of time. First of all, it's a big chunk of your income, a measurable chunk of your income. Take the time to sit down and fill out the form. One of the things the government has not done to encourage this is to make the return or the instructions in plain English. I have a daughter who's a bank executive.
They have not done this.
That's right.
Okay, I was going to make sure I wasn't speaking a different language. Okay.
No, and the commissioner who came in, was the first non-tax lawyer, Rosati, during the Clinton administration, said he was going to do this, and the bureaucracy defeated him. I have a daughter who's a banker, and she did volunteer time trying to show poor people how to do their tax returns, quickly realized that the forms overwhelmed them. So she wrote her own version of the questionnaire. And everybody in the room, when she came back with it, was able to fill out their tax return very easily because it asked the questions the way you and I would talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And why there isn't more of a movement to do exactly that, to say to people, well, you need this thing here. Here's a calculator we're giving you for the evening. Add up these numbers. Put it in this box. For short forms, it's very easy. I mean, the short form is basically a postcard.
Is the language lexicon issue a function of, you know, that political economy of tax changes, you know, like the Intuit issue?
Well, part of it is an issue of how we write the laws. I mean, if you were trying to read almost any law, whether it's the commercial bribery statutes, even the homicide statutes, you would say, wait a minute, what exactly does this say? We write the law in a very peculiar and arcane way in the actual statutes, not what we hear in the news.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason that the forms and the instructions can't be in plain English. And the principal beneficiary of that is the tax preparation industry, which takes in billions of dollars a year.
In one of your articles, you wrote about the 6 billion hours that are devoted to tax preparation every year in this country. 6 billion?
That's the official estimate that people spend $6 billion. I'm somewhat dubious of this number for a variety of reasons, but without any question, I mean, it is the functional equivalent of all the people who work at, I listed a bunch of companies, I think it's Walmart, Target, and some other large retailer for an entire year. And this is a huge deadweight waste that we shouldn't have to endure, and we wouldn't have to endure, except that we created this tax system with all of these favors in it that go principally to high-income people, and that I argue redistribute income upward, not down, in the economy. And one of the things we allow in this country, for example, that very few people know, Anne, is the very highest income people in America, the highest paid workers in history, are by Congress allowed to live tax-free. You'll hear in the news that they pay a 15% tax. I'm talking here about managers of hedge funds. But in fact, they never pay the tax until they close the hedge fund. So long as it remains open, their current tax rate is zero. And we have many people, and we have court records now coming out in various places of high-income people like the couple who own the L.A. Dodgers, the McCourts, the developer Terrence Wall, who wanted to be a U.S. senator from Wisconsin and had to make disclosures, a former U.S. senator from Georgia, whose record showed they pay no income taxes despite living very, very lavish lifestyles, because that's how the rules are written.
Can you repeat that, exactly what it is about having a hedge fund that...
Hedge fund managers are paid a portion of the increase they get in the money in the fund.
Okay.
But they don't pay taxes on it until they cash out of the fund or close the fund. So long as they reinvest their money in the fund, they pay no taxes. So Mr. Paulson, who made $9 billion over the last 2 years running his hedge fund, he is by far the most successful hedge fund manager. He does not have to pay any taxes on that money unless he withdraws it. Well, if you have $9 billion untaxed in your offshore hedge fund and your lifestyle requires, let's assume, $100 million, that's an enormous lifestyle, you simply go to your banker and you borrow. And your borrowing interest rate right now will be 2 or 3%. And I say this because I have a six-figure loan at less than 3%, and I'm just a journalist. You borrow at 2 or 3%, you're not paying the 15% tax rate. You're assets are growing much faster than the tax rate of 15% or your borrowing rate of 2%, and you live tax-free.
And the banks are willing to do this, apparently, indefinitely.
Well, you know, I mean, at some point, life runs out, and you're going to be taxed, presumably, if the government is able to track all the records back all the years you ran the hedge fund.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly lived your life without having to pay taxes. Whereas working people have no choice. We have two tax systems in America. One is for people who are workers. The government does not trust them. Congress does not trust you and me and the people listening, most people listening to the show. It requires our employers to independently report how much money we made, how much we paid in interest on our mortgages, how much we received from pensions or 401ks or any other source of income. But if you're a business owner, by the way, I'm also a business owner, or you're a landlord, the government trusts you to honestly report your full income. And there is no independent verification unless you happen to be selected for an audit.
My guest is David K. Johnston. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He spent decades examining the U.S. tax laws. If you have a question for him, we have about 3 minutes left, so you better get the question in fast, 614-292-8513, if you want to give us a call. David, do other countries have complicated taxes like the United States?
They do, and there's a consistent pattern that when a tax industry arises, a tax preparation industry, it tries to make sure that you have to keep filing. Other countries have complicated tax systems. If you're an executive in Sweden, you know, you have to file a tax return showing whether every time you went on a business trip, you got a continental breakfast, which is tax-free, or a full breakfast, which is taxed on the difference between that and the continental breakfast.
Whoa. Okay. So we can't move anywhere to escape this.
You can't move anywhere to escape it. We could get Congress to eliminate tax filing for people who basically just have wage income.
Okay. And has that been proposed before?
Oh, yes. At tax.com, where I write a column, there are pieces about this. And it's one. I know I'm a professor of law and business at Syracuse University. It's one of the things I teach my students about.
You're critical of what you call the ideological marketing organizations like Americans for Tax Reform. You say they don't seek the same kind of reforms you do, the reform of the system.
No, Americans for Tax Reform says that it opposes tax increases. Well, I've now documented two cases where Republicans violated their pledge to Americans for Tax Reform and voted to raise taxes, in one case retroactively in 2006 in a law signed by President Bush, and they never speak a word about that. Americans for Tax Reform is an organization devoted to lowering taxes on the highest income Americans, lowering taxes on business owners, and that's its focus, without any question. Remember, it's run by a man who, you know, spouts anarchist ideas. He says, I don't want to kill the government. I just want to shrink it down to the size where I can drown it in a bathtub.
Okay.
Pretty radical.
Hey, we only have about a minute left, but I want to ask you, when the average Joe American asks his elected officials to change the tax laws, what would make the biggest impact for the most people? The things you've already mentioned?
Well, the first thing would be eliminate filing for anybody who files a short form,
okay.
Number one. And don't buy Americans for Tax Reform's claim that that's an invasion of your privacy. The government already has all the information anyway. That's the number one thing. The second thing to do is let's go back to having a progressive tax system. Right now, a single worker who makes $500 a week, and half of all workers make $500 a week or less, pays 5 percentage points more in total federal taxes than people who make $1 million a day.
David K. Johnston, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and I hope some of your listeners go to tax.com.
I will. We'll post that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. That's tax.com. That's David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who examines the U.S. tax laws. Thanks for joining us today. That's all the time we have. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.